You're listening to the BibleChallenge.org Old Testament Studies. For more information, go to stpeterslakemary.org. Now here's the Reverend Charles Holt.
Take a look at 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We'll cover this book probably over 4 or 5 weeks. I can't remember exactly, but we'll treat both 1 and 2 Chronicles as a unit and look at them as a piece, because they really are. The overarching concern of the book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles is slightly different from that of 1st Kings, though they do cover much of the same material. Actually, there's overlap between Chronicles and Samuel and Kings. It covers a longer period of time, and will go through much of the same stories, but do it in brief. There will be some parts of those stories that are not in 1st and 2nd Samuel and Kings. But here's the main difference. If 1st and 2nd Kings was about educating the people who were in exile, why they were in exile, 1st and 2nd Chronicles is about educating those who are moving towards restoration. So it's written a little bit later, and it's written for the people that are moving back into the land of Judah, the southern kingdom, to restore Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And so it's actually giving them a little bit of a blueprint for what it should look like. It's kind of casting a vision of a unified, restored Israel, but also giving some indication of, we've got our second chance, guys. Let's not blow it again. So that kind of idea that we need to be faithful this time around. We need to be walking in the ways of the Lord, and we need to not forsake God and turn to the false idols like our forefathers did. So it has an emphasis on the southern tribe, Judah, as a series of books, and it's got an emphasis on the Davidic monarchy, because that's critical for being reestablishing and restoring the nation of Israel. And it also has an emphasis on the temple and reestablishing the temple and right worship in the temple. The book is sometimes believed to have been written by Ezra, and we're gonna look at Ezra, the book Ezra, a little bit later. But the many people think that perhaps the scribe Ezra is the one who wrote the book 1st and 2nd Chronicles. But it's primarily about restoration. You'll remember that the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom, or the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, fell into exile because of rebellion. Do you remember the date of the northern kingdom's fall? 722. That's correct. That's not in the handout either, is it? You do. And that is an important date to just have in your mind. 722, the fall of the northern kingdom. Does anybody remember the date of the fall of the southern kingdom? 586. That's a critical date to have in your mind as well. The next critical date is the date of the Cyrus Edict, or the Cyrus Decree, which is 538. And that's the date when Cyrus, who is the king of Persia, allows the exile Israelites to go back to their land and rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. And so those are the three key dates that, if you know those dates, you'll kind of have a sense of that time frame of the exile and restoration. Do you remember the, maybe you don't, but this past year there's been some contemporary hype about the Cyrus cylinder. Are you familiar with that? Okay. It actually is it's a cylinder that has the Cyrus Edict on there that allowed the Israelites to go back to their land. And it's making a tour around the United States, I think, all this year. And it's significant because it's a prized jewel of the nation of Iran, of all nations, who wants to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And yet they're very proud of it because it represents the glorious history of the Persian Empire, and what, sort of the heyday of that region's power and height. But King Cyrus was one of the friendliest kings and emperors in allowing the Israelites to return to the land. But pay attention to that. You know, that Cyrus cylinder, you can Google it, and read about that. It's very interesting. Okay, so part of the reason for the long section of the genealogy is, well, let me think about this. It's part of the reason for the long section is if you have been exiled and you've gotten disconnected from your heritage, it's important to reestablish those lines of genealogical connection. Especially because for a Jewish person, their identity is all wrapped up in being able to trace their heritage back to the person of Abraham, right? And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they need to be able to trace it back to Jacob as one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And if you're going to reestablish the southern kingdom, then you need to focus on three tribes, Judah, Simeon, and Benjamin. And then if you're going to reestablish temple worship, you got to focus on a fourth tribe. Which one? The Levites. So these are the four tribes that are emphasized in the genealogy, chapters 1 through 9 of Chronicles. And they're all designed to help reestablish the Davidic monarchy, the southern kingdom, and right temple worship for the nucleus of a restored people of God. So if you look on page, on the top of page 158, you'll see the general structure of 1st and 2nd Chronicles is can be divided into three main sections. The genealogy takes the first nine chapters. Then you have the United Kingdom of David and Solomon, which is Chronicles 10 through 2nd Chronicles 9. And really, that is all of a piece, even though the beginning of 2nd Chronicles is where Solomon's rule begins to be recorded. They really are the United Kingdom, and the focus in that section is on building the temple, establishing the monarchy and building the temple. And then instead of a long history that kind of goes back and forth between the fall of the northern kingdom and the fall of the southern kingdom, the emphasis in 2 Chronicles 10 through 36 is primarily on the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, all the way up to the Cyrus Edict. The book ends, 2 Chronicles ends in chapter 36, with Cyrus giving permission for the Jews to go back into their land. Okay? So the genealogy grounds the returning Israelites in their ethnic identity as children of Abraham, their heritage as Judahites, and the southern kingdom, or Levites. It establishes the Davidic monarchy, and it actually, one of the interesting, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I was gonna say, when you get to the section on David, it creates a lot of options for who could be the fulfillment of the Davidic line, and then it also places an emphasis in that recounting of the southern kingdom's history on either seeking God or forsaking God. This becomes the main theme, and that's kind of similar to 1st and 2nd Kings, where you had the recounting of the history of these kings, and you had ones that didn't walk in the steps of David, and you had others that walked in the steps of the bad kings like Jeroboam, that forsook the commandments of the Lord. In this case, you have repeated terms of seeking God and forsaking God, To seek God means to walk in His commandments, to oppose idolatry, to center your worship in Jerusalem at the temple. To forsake God means that you're apostate and you're falling away in the form of idolatry, not taking care of the temple, neglecting temple worship, letting the temple fall into disrepair, and disregard for the word of the prophets, and taking on this egregious forms of violence that we already have read about to a large degree in 1 and 2 Kings. So let's take a look at the genealogy. It begins in chapter 1 with a recounting all the way back to Adam. And so much of the first section of the genealogy grabs a lot of those names from the book of Genesis. So very much the law of Moses and the works of Genesis through Deuteronomy were very much in the repertoire and in the psyche of these exiled Israelites. They probably had the Torah scroll in their possession. They studied it and were very careful in tracking with this genealogical record back to Adam. You remember in Adam was the promise given, or actually it was to Eve, that it would be a seed of the woman who would crush Satan's head. And so this actually becomes the main theme of the nation of Israel, that it would be through genealogical progression, through the seed of the woman, that there would be saviors raised up. Abraham being, well, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and you just can follow the single individuals that will be the ones who will crush Satan's head. David. And then ultimately, we know that that will be fulfilled in one of David's descendants, Jesus. So the genealogy traces from Adam to Abraham. Abraham is, of course, a very important figure because of the promises that were given to him of, and this is in Genesis chapter 12 and Genesis chapter 15, the promise of land, the promise that he would be given a great name, that he would be a great nation, that through him all the nations of the world would be blessed. Whoever blessed him would be blessed. Whoever cursed him would be cursed. And so the covenant of circumcision was given to Abraham and his seed, his descendants, as a sign that they are to be set apart. And if you break the covenant with God, you would be cut off. Always in the signs of the covenant, you have both the positive and the negative represented. The covenant is a cutting of a covenant, a cutting of a deal. I don't want to get too graphic for you, but it sets you apart, and it also shows the curse that you would be cut off if you broke the covenant with God. So as the genealogy progresses, it traces all the way to Abraham to Jacob. And it places a bit of it's interesting to me that it places an emphasis in chapter 1, 43 to 54 on the kings of Edom. Now, who were they? They were the descendants of Jacob's brother Esau. These would be rival kings that would be trouble for the nation of Israel, and sometimes they themselves would be the ones that would reign. The great example is Herod. In the time of Christ, Herod was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau. Just little bits of trivia, making this interesting. Americans, I don't think we recognize the importance of genealogy that much. I mean, we're studying it more now because of ancestry.com. And who here has a subscription or has looked at that? The ancestry.com, yeah? couple of years ago, I had no idea of my genealogical heritage until like 2 years ago. And I started to research that, just got interested in it. My uncle sent me something that took my family heritage back to the American Revolution. And so I said, well, I wonder how far Holtz were in existence in the United States, and traced it all the way back to Jamestown. And the first Holt came over as a 13-year-old slave, actually, or actually I should say indentured servant, to his uncle, John Pott, who was the first resident of what would become Williamsburg. So, you know, that's kind of interesting when you start to realize that your family was part of history and part of the founding of the country. And it does something for you to be able to understand your roots and to be able to connect yourself back. Now, of course, that can become a source of pride. I went to the library when we just went to Williamsburg, and I wanted to go and see some of these things for myself. And I was talking to the librarian at the Rockefeller Library, and I said, I'm just so interested in all this. I got such interesting people in my heritage. And she says, I bet you have some scoundrels too. I was like, well, yeah, there's those people too. I was looking at the more positive side of my heritage, but she wanted to remind me that all of us have both good and bad in our heritage. And that's part of what's being made clear here in the genealogy. He wants the themes of both the heroes of the faith, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also we've got some scoundrels in our genealogical heritage too. And so you see the seeds of rebellion and the seeds of faith in your heritage. One of the places where we see the seeds of rebellion is in chapter 2, verse 7. Notice here he lists off all the 12 tribes of Israel. Israel is the same as Jacob, you remember. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, one who wrestles with God. And he lists off the 12 tribes, and he zeroes in on Judah. Now this will become the largest section of the genealogy, is focusing on that one tribe, Judah. This will be the one through whom David is descended. But in the tribe of Judah, you had good and bad. Notice what it says, Judah's firstborn was, this is verse 3, Judah's firstborn was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death. Now, as you're going through this, you, in a lot of ways, you just read these names, and such was the son of such and such, and such and such was the son of such and such. It's the little moments where the chronicler expands that you need to go, oh, that's important. He's making a little point there. He's highlighting that for a reason. He could highlight stories on a lot of these people, but he chose to highlight that one just to say, aha, even Judah has had an evil vein in the family and has been under God's judgment, even right from the first children of the tribe of Judah. Remember, then he goes on and starts to list the sons of Perez, Hezron and Hemel, the sons of Zerah, Zimri, Ethan, Haman, Calcol, and Dara, five in all. You guys can find a lot of good name possibilities here if you're having any children or grandchildren. You can recommend Zimri to your family. The son of Carmi, Achan. Now notice here again, he highlights a little detail about Achan, the troubler of Israel who broke faith in the matter of the devoted thing.
So don't recommend
that name. Yeah. Wouldn't name your child Achan. But again, the chronicler is wanting to highlight some of the scoundrels in the line of Judah and help keep you humble a little bit. Don't get too prideful in your heritage. Make sure that you understand that there was some good people, some heroes, but there was also the troubler of Israel, came from the line of Judah. And he broke faith in the matter of the devoted thing.
That was the Joshua just after the entering Jericho, right? Took something.
Yeah, he took some of the devoted things. But here's the thing, for the chronicler, that term, broke faith, that's going to become a repeated phrase. Okay, so again, make a note of that. He's bringing a little magnifying glass here on some of these people as he's going through the chronology to introduce some themes which he's going to develop a little bit later. Another one that that he brings up, he puts a little emphasis in verse 18 of chapter 2. Caleb, this is not Caleb of Caleb and Joshua, but Caleb the son of Hezron fathered children by his wife Azubah and by Jerioth, and these were his sons, Jeshur, Shobab, and Ardan. And when Azubah died, Caleb married Aphrath, who bore him Hur, and Ur fathered Uri, and Uri fathered Bezalel. And you might go, wow. Yeah. Now here's the thing though, why to get to Bezalel? Why is Bezalel important? Because Bezalel, if you'll remember, if your Exodus, remember Exodus? But Bezalel was the one who was the craftsman who was given the Spirit of God to be the craftsman of the tabernacle. Okay? The chronicler wants to make sure he gets to Bezalel. Because Bezalel was important, because he was the initial one that was given the Spirit of God to build the tabernacle of the Lord. This is, again, a major theme for the chronicler, rebuilding the temple. And he wants to highlight some of the heroes of the faith that were responsible for building the temple and for establishing the monarchy. So, You see some of those kinds of things in the genealogical record. If you take a look at page 159, you'll get a summary of all nine chapters, and you can see how the emphasis breaks out. The largest sections have to do with Judah, Simeon, Levi, and Benjamin. Okay? Those are the main sections of the genealogy. All three of those, except for Levi, which was sort of spread around everywhere, but all of those tribes are the southern tribes. Those are the southern kingdoms. Simeon was actually subsumed within the tribe of Judah. When you get to chapter 4, verse 9, you find another little place where there is an expansion of one figure. And this is the figure Jabez. And there was a little book that was written a while ago called The Prayer of Jabez, and everybody got excited about it and read it and started praying the Prayer of Jabez, which is basically one verse in the Bible, verse 10 of chapter 4. Jabez called upon the God of Israel, saying, "Oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my border, and that your hand might be with me, and that you would keep me from harm, so that it might not bring me pain." And God granted what he asked. Now, why would he highlight that? That's the question you have to ask when you're reading through the genealogy. Why did he lift out that prayer? Because that's the prayer. You know, Israel is being restored. And they're starting off with this small nucleus of Judah, and it's a very small representation of Judah indeed. I mean, it's a very tiny group. They're being allowed to come back and rebuild Jerusalem, but that's just one little city, and out of all the territory that God had initially given Abraham. And so what does Israel need to do? They need to pray the prayer of Jabez They need to pray and ask God that he would enlarge their territory, that he would bless them as he had promised Abraham, that he would protect them from harm and from those external invaders, and give them a blessing. God has done this in the past with his people when they pray this way. And what the chronicler is trying to get across is he'll do it in the future. If you'll ask him, God will grant what you ask. Now, I think it probably is a little bit of a misapplication to pray it specifically for, you know, extra land or something in our day and age. You know, I have a half-acre lot and I want to expand it to an acre or something like that. I think that's the wrong way of thinking about a prayer like this. But I think it's a completely appropriate prayer if you start to pray in terms of your Christian expansion of the Christian kingdom and the territory of the kingdom of God in its New Testament application. You have to, when you're taking a prayer that's an Old Testament prayer, you have to run it through the grid of the New Covenant. The inheritance that we've been promised is not land in the sense of a piece of real estate in eastern side of the Mediterranean. We have been promised land, but it's the territory of Satan, which is all of the earth. We've been promised that if we will be about the kingdom of God, that the gates of hell will not prevail against the march of the church. That's offensive. We're taking down the strongholds of Satan. And so when we pray for the enlargement of the territory, we're praying for the enlargement of the kingdom of God and that the gates of hell would come down. That's the way we should pray a prayer like the Jabez prayer. It's not a bad prayer. It's a good prayer. All the prayers in the Bible are good prayers. I know people criticize the little book some too. But it's a good prayer to pray. As long as you pray it, not have in mind, well, this is going to make me rich, you know, or give me material expansion. Pray it from the standpoint of expanding the influence of the kingdom of God and just hold on to your horses and wait and see what God might do. Because he might do some of that expansion of your Christian witness and influence. So, here we get to chapter 4, verse 24. And again, this is, I'm coming back to the genealogy of Simeon. And we see, again, some interesting little statements that are pulled out here. In the genealogy of Simeon, look at verse 33. He starts to describe their villages. And their villages were Etam, Ain, Rimmon, Token, Ashen, five cities, along with all their villages that were around these cities as far as Baal. These were their settlements, and they kept a genealogical record. Now, when you think about an Israelite, not only do you have your genealogy that connects you to your heritage back to a particular tribe, but that tribe was also given a piece of real estate that would be associated with that tribe. The land of Palestine was divided up during the conquest with Joshua. You go back and reread Joshua to get the actual pieces of real estate that corresponded. Simeon was within the tribe of Judah, but they had specific allocations that were given to them. And what the chronicler is reminding them is what those allocations were, which cities belonged to the tribe of Simeon, so that as they returned back to the land, they would have in mind, these are the ones that we need to go back to and begin to repopulate. Does that make sense? So these are critical things. Now, one of the things that the chronicler is highlighting here is they kept good genealogical records. So they knew which villages belonged to them and who belonged to those villages because they had kept those records. And that record keeping is very important to the chronicler.
The total time in exile in Purdue is 200 years, a little less.
No. Not for Judah. It was 586 to 538. What is that? Less than 50 years, right? Then you see more expansion here in this genealogy in verse 37. Ziza, the son of Shippi, I got to be careful how I say that, son of Alon, son of Jedidiah, son of Shimri, son of Shemaiah. These mentioned by name were princes in their clans, and their father's houses increased greatly. They journeyed to the entrance of Gedor, to the east side of the valley, to seek pasture for their flocks, where they found rich, good pasture, and the land was very broad, quiet, and peaceful, for the former inhabitants there belonged to Ham. These registered by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and destroyed their tents and the Menunites who were found there, and they marked them for destruction to this day and settled in their place, because there was pasture there for their flocks. And some of them, 500 men of the Simeonites, went to Mount Seir, having as their leaders Pelatiah and so on, the sons of Eshi, and they defeated the remnant of the Amalekites who had escaped, and they have lived there to this day. So this tribe is being lifted up as an example of Israel and its prime and what it's supposed to be about, and being faithful to the call to rout out those who have been allocated in the land and set apart for destruction, like the Amalekites. You then have some general descriptions of some of the northern tribes. Reuben, the descendants of Gad. He zeroes in and uses the descendants of Gad and the descendants of the half-tribe of Manasseh to create a positive and a negative example of some of the faithfulness and unfaithfulness of the northern tribes. The Gadites are lifted out as being a positive example in 1 Chronicles 5:20, where they went to war and prevailed over the Hagrites, and all who were there were given into their hands, for they cried out to God in battle. That's the key phrase. For they cried out to God in battle, and He granted their urgent plea, because they trusted in Him. So the Gadites are being lifted up as a positive example. They cried out to God because they trusted in Him, so He granted their request, and many fell because the war was of God, and they lived in their place until the exile. But then you have the negative example of the half-tribe of Manasseh right on the heels of this. They also lived in the land, very numerous, from Bashan to Baal Hermon. And look at verse 25. But they broke faith with the God of their fathers and whored after the gods of the peoples of the land whom God had destroyed before them. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, the spirit of Tiglath, Pileser, king of Assyria, and he took them into exile, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Hala, Habor, Hara, and the river of Gozan to this day. So that's where those folks are, because they broke faith. Same language as that other example we used from the tribe of Judah. Remember that theme of breaking faith is going to be throughout the book of Chronicles. So you have the positive and the negative being highlighted in these genealogies. The mention of the northern tribes, even though it's not the emphasis of the chronicler, it does reveal something very important about the larger vision. He isn't just focused on getting that southern kingdom restored, though that certainly is the emphasis. But he wants to see all of Israel restored. And the northern kingdom, or the northern tribes, are mentioned in the genealogy as a way of, in a sense, giving them a mention as being part of the family and the 12 tribes. But certainly the emphasis for the chronicler is on the southern kingdom. Okay. So then chapter 6 is focused on the descendants of Levi. You'll look at verse 15 where he describes how the exile, when the Lord sent Judah and Jerusalem into exile by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And then verse 31 is another place where he has a little bit of flourishing in the genealogy. These are the men whom David put in charge of the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark rested there. They ministered with song before the table, before the tabernacle of the tent of meeting until Solomon built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. And they performed their service according to their order. So that's a shout out to the choir. How important the choir is to right worship, right? You got it. You want to get the temple restored? We got to find these people who are of this line, who are the singing line. You know, the choir leaders and the musicians. We've got to identify these people so that we can restore glorious worship back to the temple. And so part of the reconstruction of the temple will include the reestablishment of the Levitical priesthood and the different roles that they all had. Certain ones were tasked with making the sacrifices, but others were also tasked with singing and ministering the instruments and all the different furniture. There were just different roles for all the Levites, and here's one that gets highlighted. The rest of the genealogy is kind of boring. is there any? And we're out of time too. But any questions or thoughts before we break?
The book of the Chronicle of the Kings that's so often mentioned, which is not this chronicle.
Yeah, no, that's different.
Is there any? What is the historical connection? If there is one, is that book ever actually been discovered? Is it?
I think that's been lost to the sands of time, I guess we should say. But these two books are preserved. But clearly, this book was written after 1 and 2 Kings.
Right.
And so 1 and 2 Kings is making reference to the Chronicles or the Annals of the Kings. That's a different work.
Thanks for listening. For more information, check out stpeterslakemary.org.